Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about everything and anything having to do with writing. Before we go on, I should first say that the opinions and views expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the University of California Board of Regents. Today my guest is Dr. David Elkind, child psychologist. Dr. Elkind received his doctorate at UCLA and is currently professor of child development at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. He lectures extensively around the U.S., Canada, and abroad. Has appeared on the Today Show, the CBS Morning News, 2020, Nightline, and Oprah, and has been profiled in People, and he's a contributing editor to Parents Magazine. He's also author of Growing Up Too Fast, Too Soon, All Grown Up and No Place to Go, Parenting Today's Teenager, Understanding Your Child, and the classic The Hurried Child, which was revised in 1988 and may soon be revised again. Welcome, Dr. Elkind. Are you there? He doesn't seem to be. Let's see if we can find him. Please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Let's see. Are you there, Dr. Elkind?
Yep.
Great. Great to have you.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about the.
I'm just happy we have you on the air. Tell us what The Hurried Child is.
Well, I wrote The Hurried Child 20 years ago, and at that time I was talking about children and adolescents who were expected to feel and behave and to think at much older age levels than was appropriate, and so they were being hurried to behave inappropriately, feel inappropriately, and to really think inappropriately, and that caused a lot of stress. But unfortunately, although I'd hope things would get better. In some ways, they've gotten worse. Now we're hurrying even infants and even fetuses in utero. There's not a prenatal university. So I think brain research, misunderstood and misinterpreted computers, and certainly consumerism have continued to push parents, however well-intentioned, to get children to do things earlier than would be appropriate. And I think, unfortunately, the schools and media are chiming in. So there's a lot of pressure on kids today.
How do children perceive hurrying? Do they feel that they're being rejected? Do they feel that their parents are concerned about them having lots of activities and they love them?
Well, I think children tend to have a very positive notion of parents. They tend to have the belief in the good parent. And so during childhood, they engage in a great deal of denial. For example, children of alcoholic parents will, if you interview them, will tell you that their parents are good and well-behaved and thoughtful and so on. It's only in adolescence when they come to have new mental abilities and they reconstruct their childhood, and then they begin to see a lot of the things that were done and a lot of the hurrying, and that's when a lot of kids begin to rebel. For example, kids who've been pushed into sports may drop out. They may, do more poorly in school if they've been very pressured and so on. They may feel that some of the pressures put on them were not for their own benefit, but for the parents. And so I think during childhood proper, you don't see as much resentment and rebellion as you do in adolescence.
You know, with all the information now and all the books and everything else, as far as slowing children down and allowing your children to be bored and all that kind of stuff, why is it that, you know, and a lot of stay-at-home moms, more and more stay-at-home moms these days, why is it that everyone is still hurrying their kids or afraid that their kids will hate them if they get bored?
Yeah, I've asked that question all over the country for 9 years, and no one believes in hurrying children. No one I've ever talked to believes in hurrying children. They all believe it's bad, it's hurtful, as you say, to children, and makes them stressed and so on. Nobody believes it. No parent I've ever talked to believes in hurrying children. It's bad for kids. No teacher I've ever talked to believes in hurrying children. No, it's bad for kids. We should really do age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate things. You know, any principal I've talked to says the same thing. Superintendents, really... We should do, it's good for kids. Legislators don't want to hurry kids. We want to give them a good life. And so nobody believes in hurrying children, except when they said, I don't believe in hurrying children, but, and the mother says, I don't believe in hurrying children, but if I don't put my child in this program at 4, he won't have any friends, and he won't be able to compete at 6, and won't be able to get into good school, so I don't believe in hurrying, but, and teachers say, I don't believe in hurrying, but, the school says, I have to give these tests, and I have to teach the tests, and I don't believe in hurrying, but, and the principal says, I don't believe in hurrying, but the school system says, kids have to get these grades, and if they don't get the grades, we'll be cutting our funding, so I don't believe in hurrying, but, the superintendent says, my salary is dependent upon the grades, and if we don't get them, then I don't get them. And the legislator says, voters look at grades, and if I don't get the grades aren't up, then I don't get elected, so I don't believe in hurrying. But, and so nobody believes in hurrying, and everybody, but there's always the big but. And I wish we could do away with the bare buts, but that's the but is where it always ends up, unfortunately.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Dr. David Alkine. Since I read The Hurried Child, I'm now so aware of hurrying my 5-year-old son. You know, when I say, come on, honey, we don't have much time. Come on, honey, we have to get here. You know, at those times, sometimes there's nothing I can do about it. We are late. And other times I think, why didn't I just start earlier? Why didn't I just do such and such? It's very hard to get in the habit of slowing down. Do you? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're very right. I think it is a very difficult thing for parents today. It's a very hurried society. People, futurists 20 years ago talked about all the leisure time we would have, and that we'd have, 6-hour work days and 4-day work weeks, and we all developed these leisure time hobbies and all those things. I think they're a little bit misjudged, and there really is a time famine today. Nobody has time, and everything is moving so quickly, the technology, and just keeping up with the technology and the job changes and even career changes and so on, and the demands are so great that I think we work longer hours than any other society, even Japan. And so there isn't as much time, and parents certainly are doing it with the best intentions to give their children the kind of life that they believe they should have. And so it's a very real dilemma, and there are, there are times when we can't be, we have to be hurried. But I think, as you say, sometimes planning ahead of time can reduce some of that. And also, I think one important thing to do is to set some time each week, at least each week, to have that as sort of sacred family time, whether it's a meal time or a breakfast time or just a reading time or watching television time, something that's kind of sacred and that is time for the family. The kids can look forward to that's their time and that is going to be held for them, and that the parents are going to give up whatever they need to do for that time. And I think if we make that kind of commitment, it's not, the kids can deal with a lot of the other things. If there's something, one time that's truly theirs and the family's and that they can look forward to and know that's sacred. So you may not be able to do it all during the week, but there should be some time during the week when families can have their time, and I think that's very important, and that can sort of buttress some of the pressures during the rest of the week.
Well, along those lines, in creating a schedule, say, to make sure the family has time together, do you believe in schedules in general, or is it finding the schedule that works best for your child? Should all children be in bed by 7:30, or do some children?
Oh no, I think you have to have flexible schedule. I think we are much more into schedules now, and I talked to my book on highs of stress. I talk about we've moved away from the kind of contracting, parent-child contracting to schedules because we are so busy, and the list and schedules are part of our lives today. But certainly one has to be flexible. I mean, some children need more sleep than others, and certainly you want to be sensitive to that, and you have to know the child. Some children really, if they don't get enough sleep, are really... really not able to do very well. Adolescents, for example, we know now that adolescents really need more sleep, and that they are and they need more. They often, need more sleep in the mornings, and so that many adolescents now are sleep deprived because they don't get enough sleep. So certainly, but watching the child and seeing how much sleep that child really needs to be up and alert and so on, and making sure that he or she gets that sleep. But certainly, individual. Differ. Some kids can get along with much less than others, and certainly we should, be able to be flexible enough to adjust to those needs.
In the hurried child, you said parents no longer are into protecting their children from so-called real life, but preparing them for it. Will you elaborate?
Yeah, I think we, up until really mid-century or maybe a little after, we tried to protect children. There was a Hays office that didn't allow children, that kept foul language, nudity, sexual activity out of the movies, out of the radios, and so on. And there was a concerted effort to protect children. And there was no Playboy. There was certainly nothing that you could buy on the streets like that. And so there was a sense, and we had child labor laws, and we had compulsory school laws. The legal system was there to protect children's, there was a lot of effort. Schools did not push children. There was a sense that the children needed to be protected, and that childhood was a very special place, and that children needed to enjoy their childhood, and that growing up would come soon enough. And I think a lot of things happened in the 60s and so on. And as a result, the world came crashing in to our homes through television, and more recently, certainly through computers and so on. Then we had the Vietnam War. We had a lot of stuff, and then we had the second sexual revolution, and we had premarital sex became socially acceptable. The pill. Nudity and overt sexual activity became very common on the media and so on. A lot of the taboos that were once present are no longer there. And so the world changed, and instead of protecting children, the world now became very... children were able to see everything and anything, and I think as a result, parents felt that they could no longer protect children in a way that they once did. The society was not helping them in any way. I mean, the media were presenting more and more violence, more and more sexual activity, more and more profanity. So it became increasingly difficult to protect children, and so parents said, if I can't protect them, at least I can prepare them, which... makes some sense, except sometimes I think it went too far, preparing children often for something that they wouldn't encounter until much later. For example, programs to protect children against child abuse. First place, most children will not experience child abuse, but secondly, most children, young children, are not able to protect themselves against an adult who would do them harm, so they were put at risk for no purpose. And so there's a lot of talk about AIDS and a lot of talk about, married gayness and all. And it's just that the children are not able to really understand all that. It sort of makes them frightened. The basic rule I always tell parents is don't never take anything away from a child without being able to give him or her something in return. If you can take something away from a child, his or her security or the sense of safety, then you, as an adult, are duty-bound to give them something in return to protect, to enable them to protect themselves. So certainly with young children, you just don't run in the street because you'll get hurt, and then there's something they can do. They can't run in it. They don't run in the street. Don't put your hand on something hot because you'll burn yourself. There's something they can do, not put their hand on there are things we can do, and so there are a lot of things we can teach children. But there's very little a child can do about AIDS. There's very little a child can do about sexual abuse. There's very little a child can do about gay families and gay marriage and so on. And certainly later on, children will learn about those things. But there's no even programs on death. Children really don't understand death till 8 or 9. So why talk about it earlier, unless certainly there's a death in the family or a pet dies and so on? That's the time to talk about those things. So I think that under the guise of preparing children, often parents put children, make children frightened without giving them any way to deal with the fear or anxieties they've created. And I think that's the worst part of the preparation thing, is that that sometimes, and it's given rise to a really false intuition, the idea that somehow the best preparation for a bad experience is a bad experience, and then that means sort of you're going to break your leg at 14, you might as well break it at 7, which is a wrong intuition, but it's very common, and this sort of belief that we ought to prepare. And so I think the parents have to believe, as I do strongly, after 40 years in this profession, seeing families and children in this country and all over the world, that the best preparation really for a bad experience is a good experience, and the more good experiences we give children, the better prepared they'll be to deal with whatever bad experiences they have later. I wish we could just inform parents about that so that they don't unnecessarily expose children to experiences which about which they can do very little, but makes them really anxious for no purpose.
Mm-hmm. Raising a child with principles is already a difficult thing. What about when young children want to participate in activities that other children are doing, maybe going to movies that of course everybody's going to, but you don't think is right? Or I guess what's the line between being overly restrictive and risking later rebellion and instilling the right values?
Well, I think you have, as parents, you have to believe in what you believe in. And if you believe strongly in something, then I think that's healthy, and you can communicate that to your child and say, look, I believe this is really not good for you. When you're older, you're able to see these things. I know your friends are seeing them. You probably hear about them. But I really, think that, that this is not a healthy thing for you at this age, and I'd rather you not see it. And I think kids can respect that. They may rebel later on, but, I have students whose parents didn't let them see television, and now they're in college and so on, and they don't really resent their parents. Many are better readers, and they're more motivated, and they have a lot of, they didn't feel, at the time they may have been felt left out or something, but, they'd be on the playground for 2 minutes, they could figure out what had gone on a TV program. So I think it's very important for parents to stand up what they believe in. That's what, the best thing that if you really believe it, not doing it just because you think it's the right thing to do, but deep in your heart, this is really what you feel is right for this child and what you feel is right, then I think if it comes from your own convictions and from your own example, and you have to be, honest about it. It has to be something that you live and believe in yourself. And in that case, I think children can accept it and actually admire it and may resent it and rebel against it a little bit. But, I think that rebellion is healthy. Children need something to it's like if you give in to everything, it's like a marshmallow. Children need to, react against something to discover who and what they are. They need a wall there to bounce against, and sometimes we have to put up that wall if we really believe in it, and kids may resent it, and they may rebel against it, and so on. But they know that when parents say no, and the parents say they care enough to risk a confrontation. I have so many, adolescents tell me sometimes, I don't know why these parents, they really love that kid, they tell him no, wouldn't they, about all sorts of things, including open access to a liquor cabinet. They really believe, really love that kid, they'd say no. So young people understand very much that when parents say no, they take the risk of confrontation, but they care enough to take that risk and make the sacrifice. And I think that's what the message that comes through. And if it's honestly said, and if it comes from deep parental conviction, kids may rebel against it, but deep down they welcome it and appreciate it.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Dr. David Alkind, author of The Hurried Child and many other wonderful books. You mentioned TV earlier, and I'm curious what you think in terms of what's on these days, and should we limit children as to how much they watch? Should we get rid of the whole thing? Are videos much better?
Well, again, every family is different. Certainly for young children, I think under the age of 5, one ought to be very careful about how much children watch television, for a very good reason, not just the content. But children follow the law of least effort. That is, they will get information the easiest, quickest way they can. And with television, it's very easy to get information visually. You can put the mute button on and figure out pretty much what's going on without listening. And that's certainly true for a lot of children's programs. What children need to learn during the early years is auditory discrimination. It's critical for learning to read. And what happens when children watch too much television at an early age is they don't develop the auditory discrimination skills they need for reading. We talk about reading as perceptual, but it's really auditory. You know, we've had Sesame Street for 30 years now, and children are learning their numbers and their letters earlier than ever before, but they're not reading any earlier, they're not doing math any earlier, if anything, later. And that just goes to show that just the visual and just learning letters and numbers, if most of that information is gotten visually, kids are not really listening. And so I think particularly for young children, we must be, you know, very careful to limit television watching, certainly no more than an hour or two a day. And the American Pediatric Association says nothing before the age of two. Afterwards, I think one just has to use common sense. Certainly children have other things to do. They may have books to read for school and so on. They may have some chores to run. Television should be something that should be a luxury that comes after other things that need to be done is done. And certainly some selection of that programming, although now so much, you know, there are so few children's programs. Certainly good videos are there. There are a few children's programs which are good, and so one has to be selective and careful. But, one of the important things that you can teach children is to be a selective watcher, to sit with your children, watch a program, and then after the program, talk about it. One of the things I have my students do is weekly write a synopsis of a particular program, of a family program and so on, because we're studying families, about family interactions. And I think it forces them to look at television in a very different way and to look more carefully at the plot, what's going on, and what messages are being given. So you can use television as a teaching device. You can use it for talking about certain kinds of issues, whether it's death or, you know, if you're something is coming up, a family that you know is divorcing, and that. It can sometimes be a vehicle to discuss issues that need to be discussed, and that might be difficult to just bring up out of the blue. So sometimes that can be useful, too. But like anything else, it means that one has to be involved with children and to, you know, take the time to make that a meaningful experience.
How does watching the news or seeing things like last year, the Columbine tragedy, how do those things affect kids of all ages?
Well, it depends on the age level. Again, I think that particularly for children, young children and school-age children, my feeling about much of television, not only the news, but also the sexuality and the profanity and the violence. I think what's most disturbing to children, and I think they don't verbalize it necessarily, what's most disturbing to them is that they're being allowed to watch it. There's no one out there protecting them. No, they know very well that this is you know, harmful and hurtful and frightening and disturbing. And they're wondering why they're being allowed to watch it. Why is this being shown? Why isn't there out there somebody protecting? Don't people know enough that they know that this is not something that's good for me, that this is frightening and so on? I think that's the worrisome part about it to kids, is that sense of that there's nobody out in the world is looking after their welfare. And, you know, they recognize the parents are trying to do that and so on, but there's a sense that the world as a whole is not out there trying to, you know, and I think that's the scariest part, that there's not the support and care that I think they once had with a society that was thoughtful and protected them and they could feel secure and protected. With adolescence, it's a very different, a different kind of thing. I think it's a touch of reality that I think they're beginning to experience, and it clashes with their idealism and their sense that the world can get better and that people are good. And so I think it's very disruptive, because it sort of goes against what they're just beginning to be able to construct ideals and contrary to fact ideas and being able to construct a real world, ideal worlds and so on. And it's I think it's very scary to them that here are things that maybe the ideals are not, you know, it may cool their ardor for idealism. And we look to youth for idealism. We look to youth for changing our society for the better and so on. And it's sad that they get turned off too early.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Dr. David Elkind, author of The Hurried Child, and No Place, All Grown Up and No Place to Go, and Growing Up Too Fast, Too Soon, etc., etc. Wonderful books. How's it possible to know what movies your kids can safely watch? It seems that the rating G means little in terms of certain kinds of violence. For instance, Disney movies, while there were, a lot of them are rated G, or maybe most of the animated movies.
For a child is a very useful thing, just as watching television, because then you can, even if there are violence and so on, there's a chance to talk about them, a chance to deal with some of those issues. Whereas if you're not there, so it depends on the age of the children, really. I think young children, certainly you want to be with them. But old children, again, I think giving them an opportunity to talk about the film and what happened.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I just think there's a lot more sources of information now about such things than there was before, and we can access that.
Mm-hmm. How about schools? How do schools contribute to children growing up too fast?
Well, unfortunately, it's a very complicated story, and it happens at many different levels. One of the things that has happened, unfortunately, at the early age levels is that more and more children today are in early childhood settings for some part of the day. It was, even until mid-century, less than 40% of kids had some kind of early childhood experience. Today, it's more like 85% of children have been in one other child care facility. And as a result, administrators have said that because young children have had some early childhood experience, they all assume that's educational experience, and that therefore children should know their numbers and the letters by the time they get into first grade. First grade used to be a very flexible time. Teachers were able to take children, recognize some had early childhood experience, some had not. And so first grade was very flexible in terms of introducing formal instruction. But as a result of the fact that so many children now have early childhood experience, the first grade has become much more rigidified. And now children are expected to know their numbers and letters by the time they get into first grade. If they don't, then they are held back or put in transition class, which is really not very good for kids. And so in some communities, it's 25 to 50% of kids are being held back, which doesn't make any sense at all. But again, it reflects the fact that this is the rigidification of the system and the fact that children grow at different age rates. You know, at that stage, intellectual growth is very rapid, and children grow at different rates, just as they grow at different rates physically. So some children will get new mental abilities, especially calls concrete operations, the age of reason that the ancients called. Some children get it at 4, some get it at 5, some get it at 6, some get it at 7. They all get them, and they're essential for learning, going into formal education, which involves rules, because those operations allow children to understand rules. So you're forcing children to putting everybody at the same place because of their age, and neglecting the fact that children grow at very different levels. So one of the things is that we're unfortunately putting too many children in transition classes, retaining them, making them feel badly about themselves, like failures and so on, for no reason other than that the rigidification of the system. So that's one major thing that's happening around the country, too many children going to school to learn that they're too dumb to be there, which is unfortunate. Schools should not be, solving society's problems, but they shouldn't be producing low self-esteem in children, which is some schools are doing. And then there's the curriculum, pushing the curriculum downward because of this notion of children competent, being much more competent, not innocent any longer, they're competent, and not need to be prepared, and so they can learn things earlier than we've assumed before. And so things like decimal fractions, once we're taught in sixth grade, and kids learn them in a couple of weeks now, often are taught in fourth grade. It takes children a month, and they still don't understand. So what's the point? And we see that all along. They're pushing, children are being over-tested, which is tremendous stress for children all around the country. Children are being over-tested even now at kindergarten and first grade, as well as second grade.
I was very surprised about that. My kindergartner is going to be tested next week, it's bizarre. It's like, why?
And they're not good test takers. The tests aren't any good, and what are you going to do with the tests once you have? So it's, the schools are unfortunately adding to the stresses of children rather than taking away. And in Massachusetts, we've done away with many schools with recess, which is absolutely insane. because they want to have more academic time. But children need to get up and run around just as adults do, and even more so. And so I think schools are moving away from being places where children could be feel young and protected to feeling places where children are feeling very pressured.
Now, is this something parents can affect? And what I mean is, say your child's in a grade where recess is taken away. Can you have any effect by going to the PTO meeting, or is this part of the...
No, I think that parents can have it, but they have to work as they have to come together. I think parents have a powerful influence, but you can't do it alone. You have to go as a group, and you have to have a united front. And the parents go as a united front and all go ahead together. The problem is that parents aren't a united front. Some parents are for this kind of thing. They want their kids to have more academic time and so on. And that's where the rub is, that some of the parents go along with the schools and don't recognize that this is not appropriate for children. But if you, I think parents need to today to band together, and you can get, when you do, and you can get, many principals are more than happy to. They don't feel, they're just doing what, you know, it's handed down to them, and if they can get a good parental force to support them, then I think they can be much more, you know, have a, make a stronger case for not doing some of these things. So I think parents can, if the more they get involved and the more they unite and the more they present a strong front, the more action they can get in their schools. I think that that's the only way you're going to do it, unfortunately.
Do you think homeschooling is a good idea?
Well, homeschooling is certainly increasing. There's more than 1 million people now homeschooling their children, and certainly, you know, if you have the time and the commitment and the energy to do it, it can be a good experience. Particularly if you don't, you know, it's you use the environment and don't, you know, just follow a rigid curriculum or something, but really make it a real use the nature and use the facilities and museums and libraries and all those wonderful things. It can be a really a good experience, and many people have done very well. I don't see it as the wave of the future. It's simply that too many, we have too many single parents, too many two-parent working families for that to be, it means a real commitment on the part of the couple. But for those parents who choose to do so and have the time and the energy and the commitment to do so, it certainly can be a wonderful experience for children, and many school systems are now allowing homeschool children to participate in sports and art and music and that sort of thing, so they're not deprived of those extracurricular assets.
What about peer pressure? You know, there's when your child goes to first grade, he or she is among other children for, you know what, for six at least 6 hours a day. How much does that affect children, and does a good home life and a balanced home life and a trusting home life offset any negative influences?
I think so. Really, peer group doesn't really click in until about third grade. I mean, kids are talk about friends at four and five, but the peer group influence and really wanting to do it, it really doesn't appear. And then, the peer group at any age level, if it has any power at all, it has so because it fills a parental vacuum. Children who are well parented find peers who share the same values, same beliefs, and same orientation they do, and that's true for adolescents as well. It's only peers who have, young people who have not been well parented who look to the peer group for direction and guidance and morals and so on. And so if, as you say, if parents have a good home life, if parents have their own values that they clearly, you know, modeled in their own behavior, children will find other children who share the same values and beliefs. And so the peer group has no intrinsic power. It always takes its power from an absence of parenting.
Well, how can parents discourage certain friendships without making the child angry?
Well, it depends, again, on the age. I think the most important thing is to have credibility. Sometimes parents reject friends on the basis of appearance, and they have a nose ring or an earring and so on. They say, wow, forget it. Sometimes I think it's very useful to have that child for dinner, or to have the child for a play date or so on, and be there. And then when you talk about not having that child as a friend, you have talked from a position of having observed that child in some situations, and you can talk about certain behaviors that you think are not appropriate. So it's I think, giving yourself the opportunity to observe and to give yourself credibility in your child's eyes in whatever way that you can, so that you're not, you know, shooting off off the cuff and from the hip kind of thing, but really are talking from a place where you really made the effort to understand and see that kind of kid in some different circumstances, and to have enough idea that this is not a really good playmate.
Do parents care too much about making children happy or unhappy? Are we too afraid about our children being unhappy with us if we limit them in certain ways? And is that why we don't?
Well, I think there is that today, unfortunately. I think there's too much concern about whether or not children like us. I recall as growing up that I was the youngest of six. We were not a working class family, and my mother was busy. She had, had a lot of kids to take care of, and house to clean, and clothes to wash, and cook, and so on. And didn't without the modern conveniences that we have today. And I sort of wanted something, a Captain Midnight badge or something. I don't know. We had to send away so many nickels and box pops. We didn't like the cereal anyway. And I kept pestering her and pestering her. I want. And she finally looked at me and turned around and had this long hair that she had a bun in the back of her head. And so she looked at me and said, "Who cares what you want?" She didn't worry very much about what we wanted. She cared a great deal about what we needed, but she was able to distinguish between what we wanted and what we needed, and because she didn't worry about whether or not I liked her. It was not a concern of hers whether I liked her. And I think I wish parents could have that attitude, that their role as a parent, and it's not to be liked and disliked and so on, but your role as a parent, and your role is to provide that child with the best kind of education and child rearing and modeling and moral that you can, and whether or not you're liked is beside the point, and we shouldn't look to our children for, and the truth is that if we're good parents and if we're thoughtful and we're, if we try to give them meet their needs and don't worry about their wants, they're going to love and respect us much more than if we try to be friends with them and then they won't respect us.
Is building self-esteem in children a good thing? We hear so much about it, that...
I think it's overdone. Certainly children need to feel good about themselves, but I think that has to come from behavior and so on. And I think we're all human. We all make mistakes. We say the wrong thing. We do the wrong thing. We should feel badly at times. Guilt is a healthy emotion, and certainly a child who is hurtful, does something that's unnecessarily painful to others, certainly should know about that, and a little guilt is healthy. Certainly you don't want a child to feel so guilty that it overwhelms him or her, but a certain amount of guilt in all of us, it helps us to think about what we do and try not to do the same thing later on. So certainly we want to help children feel good about themselves, but sometimes they need to feel badly about themselves, and that's healthy too.
Hmm. Do you see a difference between kids raised in affluent communities and kids raised in middle or lower income communities?
Well, certainly. But again, it depends a lot on the parents. There are many affluent parents who are very good parents and don't let the affluence, influence them. And we see many children who come from affluent families who are very, dedicate their lives to social, causes and to society and so on. And then we see many lower-income kids who get in a lot of trouble. So it depends really on the parents. I think parents, regardless of their affluence or poverty, I see many parents who are, single parents, poor single parents, do a good job of raising their kids because they know where they have their head on, screwed on right, and they do, they work hard. They try to give their kids the kind of right attitudes and morals and so on. So I think it's much less how much money you have or don't have, as sort of your attitude and about parenting and your selfhood. And I think I see good parents coming from all walks of life, all ethnic, racial groups, and all socioeconomic levels. Plenty of kids from affluent families who are in a lot of trouble.
What about children and stuff? Children want this toy or that toy, and how do you sort of moderate that in terms of at a young age, at say age five, do you have children work for things they want? Do you give them one toy a month? How do you deal with all of that?
Kids are, it used to be that presents meant something. You got presents at Christmas, you got presents maybe at Easter, maybe your birthday, and that sort of thing. And then presents meant something or on certain occasions. And I think we should go back to that. I don't think children just automatically have everything they want. And certainly, again, if they want things, then at a certain point they may have to pay for them from their own allowance and so on. And I think you have to limit that, too. We're such a consumer-oriented society that increasingly, every movie has all kinds of things and the Pokemon and so on. And I think you have to, to set some limits on that. And certainly you don't want kids not to have what everybody else has, if they'll be ostracized and so on. But I think putting limits on how many things and how many Pokemons or how many things, using common sense, we're the consumerism is I think, really devouring kids, and kids are being exploited by it. I think we need to protect our kids all the way, you know, and allowing kids to sometimes make their own things and to use their imaginations. The problem with buying things all the time is that they never get a chance to make their own toys and make their own time. And boredom is okay. You know, kids are okay to be bored.
It seems that a lot of parents are afraid of boredom, and so they're shuttling their children to soccer, of course, is a big one. But, you know, I know so many parents here in Newport Beach who are just going nuts trying to fulfill their child's social calendar, and they don't seem to know how to stop, and they're afraid of stopping. What sort of practical things can you advise that people can do to slow down, to allow their children to be bored and be okay with it?
Well, sometimes kids can be taken to a play area instead of playing an organized team sport, just be taken to a play area and allowed to play. Let them play without their own games and so on. I think we always feel that kids always have to be in some kind of adult games. And sometimes taking kids to a play or a group of, and allowing them just to play, to do whatever they want to do. And it's okay to and sort of have time where there is nothing scheduled, and simply say, this is your time and you have to decide what you want to do with it. And you can read, you can watch television, you can draw, you can paint, you can do whatever, you know, it's your time and you have to, you can use it. And so I think giving children time and making it their time and making it their responsibility to use that time in some way is a healthy thing. And I think parents have to, you know, at a certain point in life, there isn't going to be someone around programming them. They're going to have to, you know, do their own things. I see with so many of our students who have been so over-programmed, and once they have the freedom at the university, they don't know how to organize their time, and they really struggle because they really, you know, have been so over-programmed, they don't really know how to organize their own time. And so one of the important things about having, you know, boredom and extra time is the children learn to schedule it and set up their own schedules and how to use their own time and to organize it rather than having somebody, you know, order it for them all the time.
Yes. This is Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is Dr. David Alkine. We're hearing more and more about suicide in teenagers, and I'm curious what you think about this. Where are we at with this? Why is this happening? Does this have to do with children being hurried and pressured? Does it have to do with something else?
Well, certainly the hurrying and the pressure certainly contributes, and certainly I think young people commit suicide for the same reason adults do. They're under stress, and they have sometimes what I call a personal fable, this belief that they're special and unique, and sometimes that's very positive. They can feel they're special and unique in a positive way, but they can also feel it's special and unique in a negative way, that no one else has ever done anything as stupid or dumb as bad as they have, and that contributes. Great many suicides, male suicides, often are young men who are homosexual and a due proportion of young people and struggling with that whole issue and their whole identity kind of thing. But I think so many young people are just overstressed today, you know, from early childhood on. There are all kinds of pressures from school, from family. I think if you just look at the stresses on kids today, the academic stresses, the family stresses, the sexual stresses, kids being pressured to become sexually active early, all the other things that are going on in young people's lives today. And so I think that what we see in the suicide rates are simply the sort of things I've been talking about, that kids are under much more stress today, and one way of dealing with stress is suicide.
Mm-hmm. What about sex education in the schools? Is this something that is a good thing for the schools to be teaching? And is there any way parents can influence it one way or another?
Well, I think parents can't rely on schools to do it. It can be done well, and schools can be done badly. But parents have to do the sex education themselves. It's uncomfortable and so on. But I think they have to talk about sex with the young people, and even before that, talk about puberty and the changes that are going on. It happens so early now that the pressures for sexual activity and so on, that parents really have to talk about it, and not once, but many times. And sometimes they can use, again, a movie like, American Beauty is a good opportunity to talk about sexuality with young people, using a TV show or something. So it just isn't out of the blue, but you can talk about it in those contexts. But it's so important for kids to hear it from their parents and to learn, you know, that it's a pleasurable activity. It's something that you're going to enjoy and so on. But it's better to hold off, and that all that we know is that younger people become sexually active, the more heterosexual problems they have later. And I always say, look, you know, there's an age for drinking, an age for driving, an age for smoking, an age for getting married, an age for going in service, and so on. And we have those ages for a certain reason. It takes a certain maturity to do those things. And we don't have an age for sexuality, but I wish we did, because it's exactly the same thing. You're older, you have better, it'll be more meaningful to you, you'll be better judging, and so on. And so, putting both talking about the, and more, but not just about the plumbing, but also about the interpersonal relations, that it's an interpersonal relation, that you're dealing with another person and feelings and emotions. And so it has to be present in those contexts, but I think parents can't rely on schools. They really have to do it themselves, and not once, but many times. And it is uncomfortable, but I think that young people appreciate it, because school sex education classes are very, very tremendously, and most kids get their information from other kids, and that's not very good information.
So is this something parents should do when children begin asking questions, however
no,
young?
I think when they begin to be pre-pubescent, I think is a time to begin talking about puberty and the kind of changes that are going to happen in their body and the feelings that go along with it, and changes in the hair, and sweating and ejaculation, all those things. Certainly girls know about periods and so on, but to talk about that, and sometimes using books and illustrations and so on is useful. I don't think parents can really rely on the schools. They really have to do it themselves.
Any advice for parents today?
Well, I think the most important thing we can give a child, or children, is the feeling that they're important in our lives and we care about them deeply. It's a really critical thing, and however we can do that, whatever way we make it clear to them how important they are to us, doing little things for them, going out of our way for them, it really means sacrificing for kids. If they have that sense that we care about them deeply, they're important in our lives, I think they can deal with a lot of stuff later on. The most difficult thing for parents is to see that child as an individual and not that it's not about me, it's about them, and to try to allow them to be the best kind of people that they can be, but to be the person they can be, using their own talents, abilities, and so on, without our foisting what we would like them to be. Certainly we want our children to be successful and so on, but it's so important to let them follow their own bent, and I think that's... And the other thing is that young people need to feel that they belong, so allowing them to belong to the family, but also to groups, and having a religious affiliation is a wonderful thing. Belonging to organizations, a sense of belonging is really critical as well. So children feel that they belong, have a sense of belonging, have a feel that they're important and valuable. Those things, two things, that they can do pretty well.
Dr. Elkind, I very much appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry we had the trouble last time.
Not a problem. We all is well as that ends well, right?
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That was Dr. David Elkind, author of The Hurried Child. Next week, my guest will be author Martha Lawrence, whose mystery series features psychic detective Elizabeth Chase. And Sarah Davidson, author of Cowboy. That show will be rebroadcast in the next month or two, so I'll let you know about that. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You can access Writers on Writing on the Internet as well at kuci.org, and you can email me through the Writers on Writing site there, too. It is still National Poetry Month, and I have a poem for you by Virginia Hamilton Adair, and it's an appropriate poem for today and for this weekend, which is Easter. It's called The Lost Gospel. At dawn, you give your upper garment to the wretch shivering by the roadside. At noon, you're knocking on doors, some open, some slam. The day smiles on you. You give thanks for its warmth. Fever departs from the bedridden one, flowing into the sun, descending its bright ladder into darkness. You have no food, but look, a little windfall apple has rolled into the ditch, offering itself. You give thanks and eat. The cold hands of night reach for you across the desert, and together you whisper to the stars, while the immensity of darkness draws close around you, covering you like the garment you gave away in the dawn. You are like a child whose father bends down to comfort him into sleep. Tomorrow you will walk to a hill with others following, eager to hear something new, and the words of blessedness will be blown on the breath of that simple day, around and around the world, forever and ever. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thanks for listening.